You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the podcast where we're talking about Bitcoin. Backed by popular demand is the one and only Mr. James Lavish. James is an expert in macroeconomics with a CFA, Yale alumni, 2 decades of institutional investing experience, and risk management. During our chat, James gets into the details why Western countries are starting to enter into a debt spiral. We talk about how central banks are likely to make adjustments to the supplementary leverage ratio, or SLR, why it's important, and what it means for risk assets, bonds, and Bitcoin. We continue a discussion we had about Japan from a few quarters ago, what's in store for credit markets, and much more. This is a chat that you will not want to miss, so get ready. Here's my conversation with James.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Like I said in the introduction, I'm here with James Lavish. James, welcome back to the show. I think this is the third time we've chatted. Awesome to have you.
It is. Yeah, thank you for having me again. I love coming on your show. I'm a huge fan and always like talking to you, Preston.
Well, you got to see a little behind the scenes where I had a technical nightmare tonight working with my new computer. Oh, my Lord. We got through it, though.
As my wife likes to say, is tech happens.
So it's been brutal for me lately trying to get this new computer up and working. But that aside, let's jump right into this. You wrote an awesome write-up about this debt spiral that's currently taking place here. And you're just talking about the U.S. You're not even talking about some of the other places in the world. All the numbers you were throwing out there was the U.S. numbers. Walk us through the layout of all of this. Really break it down for us so it's simple to understand.
Yeah, so absolutely. I have to give kudos to Greg Foss because he and I were talking about it. And, you know, he's like, man, you've got to write about this. This is just, it's a major problem. I said, yeah, I think you're right. And so I dug in. And, you know, the thing is, we talk about debt to GDP all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Preston. And you look at all the countries who have debt to GDP that are over 100%. We've got that chart in there in some of my recent posts, and it's got that awesome, chart that shows all of the that kind of spiral of all of the economies that are running over their debt over their GDP, and that's a good baseline measure for you to get an idea of if there's a problem. I mean, you know, we've talked about Japan, we'll talk about that later, but people usually think, well, the U.S. is fine. The U.S. is, yeah, they're running their debt to GDP is over 100%, and now if you look at it, it's 137%. But they've always, you know, we've been running deficits for a long time. It's not that big of a deal. But then when you stop and you think about it and you actually do the math, like it was a company, like it's a company that's operating and borrowing as it's operating, right? I mean, it's no different than if you were Microsoft or you were Apple and, you know, but you're running your operation and you've got your expenses and you will borrow money at cheap rates in order to put leverage on your balance sheet to grow faster, grow quicker, you know, larger. And so we can do that. And we've been doing it successfully for a long time. But the problem is now we're running deficits that are so large that when you just pull out the big pieces, right? So you kind of condense it down and isolate out the big pieces. You've got your entitlement spending, you've got your interest on your debt, and those should be less than your tax revenues, right? Your revenue coming in are the taxes off of your gross domestic product. And those are broken down into all of the categories. You know, you've got your corporate tax, your capital gains, you know what all the taxes are. We won't go into all of the nuances there. But the bottom line is right now, where we stand in the United States, I was going through the Congressional Budget Committee and what they're coming up with on all of their estimates for the year 2022, right? And right now, they're estimating $4.8 trillion of taxes. Well, when you take out $3.7 trillion of entitlements, now those are in legislation. Those are not flexible. Like that's got to be paid, right?
Yeah.
And you estimate $800 billion for defense spending, Well, you're left over with $300 billion for interest expense, but we're currently running interest expense at $400 billion. So it doesn't take a math genius to figure out that we're running in a deficit, right? So that's, first of all, that's a problem. So how do you cover that? Well, you can either raise taxes, which actually negatively impacts your GDP in the long run, right? So your productivity goes down if you raise taxes. It's just natural, right? You can cut entitlements. That's not popular, especially in election year. So no politician likes to cut entitlements. No politician likes to cut spending. We've seen it on both sides of the aisle. It doesn't matter. And the other thing you could do is you could borrow. You could just issue more debt, which is exactly what we're doing, right? So you issue more debt to cover that deficit. But you know, and I know that we've been talking about this for a long time, is the problem is you're issuing more debt into a rising interest rate environment. And so as you're borrowing money that's more expensive. You're putting more debt on your balance sheet that you have to pay off with higher interest rates. So, I mean, if you think about it, it's kind of like if you take out a balance on a credit card, right? And you run up that credit card balance. For people who, like, this is kind of hard to get your head around, but to simplify it to the essence of it, you take out debt on a credit card, you run it all the way up. Well, the monthly payments that you have to pay after paying for your mandatory things like mortgage, car loans, food, you know, you can't meet that because your interest rate payments on your credit card, your minimum payments are too high. So you take out another credit card to cover some of the expenses, whether it's the food or the other interest, the interest expense of your credit card, then you're taking out more debt. But the thing is, when you do that, your interest rate is going to go up because your credit is going down. Your credit is getting worse. So it's more expensive for you to borrow, right? So as you do that, then you get into a situation where, okay, now you've maxed out another credit card. You're still not meeting your obligations. And now when you go out to take out another card, the credit card, the interest rate is even higher. So you get into this trap. You're trapped. You can't get out of it. The interest rates are going up on your credit card borrowing. Your monthly earnings are not meeting that. Like, they're not keeping up, right? And so that's, in essence, for an individual, that would be a debt spiral. And we see it happen all the time in the United States. You know, we're a completely indebted country. So, but it's exactly what's happening in the US. So
at a government level,
at a government level. So exactly. Thank you. So if you look at where we are now, and then you tack on the fact that interest rates are going up, let's just say, and you can look across the yield curve right now, and everything's right about 3%, right? So if the government's going to issue debt, it's going to be at about 3%. Let's just say it's at 3.2% to make the numbers kind of round here. And if you use 3.2% on the $30 trillion of debt that we have currently, and we have to replace that over the next number of years, that's $1 trillion of interest expense. That's $600 trillion more than we currently have at $600 billion more than we have at our current rate of $400 billion.
Yeah, it's the number goes up so aggressively with just even the slightest change in interest rate.
Exactly.
That exactly. I just don't think people understand that we're not dealing with a linear type situation right now. And
Exactly. And that's the problem. So we're watching the Fed kind of squirm, and they know that they can't raise rates too high. So they've been trying to do is raise them quickly without breaking the markets. That's just one part of it. But as our markets go lower, their tax revenues are going lower, right? The government's tax revenues are going lower. So you have lower capital gains taxes, right? As the interest rates go up, it squeezes margins for companies. So their corporate tax rates are going down. Individual tax rates are going down as we enter a recession. And so now you've got a situation that your interest payments are going up and your tax revenues are going down, and it's just a spiral. There's no way out of it. So I want to quantify, I don't think that we're in a situation, Preston, where the world is ending for the United States or the US dollar tomorrow. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that if you look out, there's just no way out of this trap. There's no way that they can fix the problem. So what are their solutions, right? And by the way, this is before investors around the world demanding higher rates for the increased default risk, right? And I don't know when that happens, right? So, but you know, we're in a situation now where the demand for U.S. Treasuries is lower, right? The global energy crisis is causing countries to sell U.S. Treasuries to raise dollars to pay for more oil, right? Because they don't want to. The last thing they want to do is have their currency being sold. Like, and we can go right into Japan off of this, but the issue is, how do they bring all those U.S. treasuries to the market in order to pay for this deficit? And so the piece that you had said, you know, you and I were talking about earlier about Luke Gromans newsletter, and he's a brilliant observation. And that is that the debt markets they're kind of mirroring where we were in 2019 and how the U.S. treasury, right? So exactly what we're talking about here. Right, we know that they have to sell more treasuries.
It's everything, right? Minus the rising interest rate environment, right? And it was bad back then, and now it's like insane.
Yeah,
go ahead. I'm sorry, I kind of stepped in, but
no, it's exactly right. So you know, back in 2019 when they raised. Okay, so right now we've just gotten word that the Treasury is raising the third quarter borrowing estimates by $262 billion. Remember what I just said, right? So they're raising it by $262 billion. Why? Because of a drop off in tax receipts and an expectation that tax receipts are going lower. Of course, we just discussed that, and increased spending, more entitlements. You know, I don't know what. You know, we've got a lot of spending. It's a gargantuan engine up there in DC. God help anybody who can figure out where all the money's going. But so now you're talking about, the new estimate is $444 billion of treasury issuance versus $182 billion. Well, who's going to buy those?
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is it mirrors the 2019 situation where they did the same thing and they raised it by about the same amount. And their total was $433 billion. And what happened? The repo market locked up. Interest rates went, the repo rate went through the roof. And so the Fed had to step in and save the market, right? So what do they do? So this time the Fed's trying to decrease its balance sheet at the same time. So they're trying to sell treasuries themselves on top of this, it through quantitative tightening, right? You and I have talked about, we've posted back and forth on Twitter a number of times. Hey, look at how fast the balance sheet is coming down. Ha ha. It's not moving.
Yeah.
Why? They know they can't send more treasuries into the market knowing that they're in this situation where tax receipts are going down, entitlement costs are going up, and there's no buyers.
Yeah.
Right? You know, we've had countries around the world, China and Russia, scrambling to get all their treasuries off their balance sheet. So what can they do?
This was a quote from Luke's article, just so people can hear real simply the way Luke described it in his write-up. He said, the Fed is attempting to shrink its balance sheet into a toxic combination of a sharp rise in the third quarter U.S. Treasury issuance, insufficient foreign U.S. demand, and a weakening global economy, but this time with a kicker of an existential global energy crisis to boot. And some of the numbers that you were quoting there, James, on 1 August, the U.S. Treasury increased its quarterly borrowing estimates by a whopping 143% to $444 billion from $182 billion, which is what they were expecting. And then this was an interesting quote he also had in there. He said, Jamie Dimon August 14th, said that he estimates a 90% chance the U.S. economy goes into a recession or worse. And the "or worse" part made me laugh because it reminded me of when I was a kid watching the old Batman TV show, when Robin said to Batman, he said, Batman, we could have been killed or worse.
or Hermione.
Yeah, we could have been killed or worse.
Or worse, expelled.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's just.
Yeah. I mean, we're sitting here laughing about it, and it's not funny.
What else can you do? It's nuts.
It's ridiculous that we're in this situation, right? Okay. So what can they do? Well, we know that, you know, we've been laughing about the Fed going up to Jackson Hole this week to have their, you know, their annual meeting. I mean, the awareness there, the social awareness there is just at, I mean, rock bottom, right? To go to, I love Jackson Hole. It's beautiful. I don't know. Is the government out there?
Yeah.
While we're in this major problem. And anyway, so the world's on fire, everything's fine. But so we're talking about what can Powell do? Well, you know, we've watched the markets kind of fluctuate pretty dramatically around his comments and the other Fed governor's comments. And so he's walking this really thin line, right? So he doesn't want to break the markets, but he's got to get inflation down. But he knows that he can't raise rates too high because it could break the bond market. And he knows that the Treasury is over there on the other side, and they're supposed to be separate, right? So I wrote a piece about this in another newsletter about the Fed and how it's supposed to be separate. Of course, it's super political. I mean, it's obvious, but they're supposed to operate separately. Well, the Treasury's over here, and they have a balance sheet issue a revenue and expense issue that the Fed is now going to exacerbate by raising interest rates. So they know that. So what can they do? Well, they can let inflation run hot. And so we've been talking about this, and Greg and I've been talking about it for a while, they're going to quietly, I think, they're going to quietly raise the inflation target from 2% to like 3 or maybe even 4. And they're just going to let it run a little bit hotter. And it allows them then to, you know, monetize the debt. It allows them to pay down the debt with cheaper dollars, you know, in the future. And so that's one thing they can do. I don't know how long they can do, because we said it again, you know, as soon as they pivot, and we're talking about QE infinity, right? So I don't think they're going to pivot before the economy kind of breaks. I don't think that, and this is my personal opinion, I don't
know. Yeah, I agree with you.
But I don't think that Powell is going to pivot until it's absolutely abundantly clear that inflation is coming down. Well, you know, the indicators are there, but employment's still high, CPI is still high. And so, you know, as long as the employment is, they've got the dual mandate, as long as it's kind of at full employment, they've got to get inflation down. Well, he's going to continue raising rates until the employment number moves, right? So unfortunately, as we've seen, and we've seen evidence of, employment often is the last indication of a recession. The employment number comes down after the recession already hits, right? So that's an issue. So what else can they do? They can let it run hot, but we get into the same problem. CPI goes through the roof, asset prices, you know, just soar, and whoever's closest to the spigot gets benefit of the dollar printing, the Cantillon effect, and then you're back to where we were in February, in January, right? But even worse. So there's another thing they can do, which I haven't seen many people talk about yet. I've heard Lynn say something about it before. Lynn Alden say something about it.
SLR.
Recently, I can't remember when. Exactly. Yeah. So, and if they change the reserve requirements, or they just let...
Tell people, banks, so the SLR is the supplementary leverage ratio, and this is how much treasuries the bank is allowed to hold on their books, right? That amount for how much they have lent out.
Exactly. It comes out of the great financial crisis and the new leverage ratio laws and what banks can hold. But what they could do is just, and that's exactly right. See, perfect. Keep it simple. And so, but what they could do is they could either change that ratio or just say, well, you don't need to have a ratio at all in this environment, because it's so important. As the repo market starts to break, we're going to need you to come in and buy these treasuries. Okay. So, I mean, we know there's a $2 trillion plus of cash out there that we've got reverse repoed you know, constantly. Well, that cash could go buy those treasuries. The treasuries go on the bank's balance sheets. And what is that? That's essentially a form, a sneaky form of additional QE, right?
Yeah.
I mean, right? So, I mean, it's money that that was printed in the last 2 years that they're using to buy the debt, to monetize the debt. I mean, it's kind of...
Now,
where do we go from there?
Are the yields going to start getting suppressed from reality? Like the reality of going higher?
It's a form of yield curve control. Absolutely. It's a form of yield curve control. So let's talk about that. So we've seen, I mean, look, I don't know when this happens, but I do know that there's decreased, you can see it. There's decreased demand for US treasuries. And at some point you're going to hear about the overnight repo market breaking. And just like it was in 2019, I think that Luke is 100% correct.
And he thinks it happens soon. Like in his newsletter,
he thinks it's imminent. Yeah.
Yeah. Like yeah. weeks.
Yeah. I mean, he's right that the Fed should be pausing at least by now, but I don't think they're going to. They're going to raise rates again, 50 basis points in September. And then I think they're going to raise them again, unless something happens, something changes. They'll raise them again in November and December and then pause.
So this was something that was tweeted out tonight. I know it's by Zero Hedge, but this is what they said. Kash Kari, who's the Fed official, says, very clear Fed needs to tighten monetary policy. And then this is their snarky reply to his comment. It said, translation, very clear, only way to fix collapse in commodity supply is with millions of unemployed workers. And so I find their reply to be very, I know they're joking, but they're serious at the same time. Is like, hey, so we keep tightening. We already have like severe disruptions in commodity supply chains. And so now we're going to like get a whole bunch of people laid off to only make that worse and only make these desirable goods and services continue to go through the roof because people are now getting laid off. Like at what point does the playbook from the last 40 years, are we at the point now where that playbook is, you got to literally throw it out?
Scrap it. Yeah. I mean, like remember the leverage where we are in right now. I mean, we've never gone through a recession like this where we have debt to GDP far above. I mean, we're above 100%. We're at 137%. We're not making enough money to pay for it. Like we're just
the interest expense. We're trapped.
And it's just a question of how long we can play the charade. I think that Russia is kind of calling us out on it.
Oh yeah. I think their whole move was that, wasn't it?
They're just like, look, it's fake money. It's monopoly money. Everybody wake up. It's monopoly money. And then when we pulled them off of SWIFT and we seized treasuries, like that's just,
it was insane.
I mean, I think it's insane. I think it was a fumble, you know, and oops. And everybody's looking around saying, you know, India, China, like they're looking around saying, well, they're, you know, we can't trust that that the treasuries we own they're going to make good on them. That's insane. If we want treasuries to be the reserve asset of the world, well, we should honor them, right?
So,
I mean, it's,
James,
yeah.
James, I would say.
I mean, I'm not saying, forget about ethics of war or anything like that.
Focus,
The math. Yeah.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, no, I gotcha. When I'm looking at like how bad, and what we were describing was all US-based math. When I look at the European situation,
11th grade
math. Yeah, thank you. When I look at the European situation, it seems way more dire, way more insane, way more difficult from just like, what is the incentive structure? Who is a net exporter? Is there any left in Europe? Because it used to be Germany and now they're not even net exporters.
Germany was it, right? Yeah.
And so, they're like in a real like make or break energy crisis.
I mean, look at this. They're in a major problem, right? So you just saw the French energy costs that I sent out that posted a chart about the French energy prices. The amount that the prices are up and everywhere. It's everywhere in Europe. They're just soaring. Well, they don't have capacity, right? So they don't have capacity. So how do they get capacity online? Well, they took three nuclear generators offline in Germany, right? And they were supposed to decommission six. Well, they've decided that, okay, well, we won't decommission the last three. I mean,
I thought they were going to do that after December.
Yeah, they're going to keep it through December, at least to get their people through the winter. Although to me, I think winter goes through March ish, right? I don't know who's in charge up there, but and then you've got, but just talk about the money situation out there, though. I mean, they've had free money for 11 years. In fact, they're paying you to take the money, right? Not really, because you can't get negative interest rates from a bank. But they had a negative key target rate, right? The key interest rate, the ECB held it below zero for 11 years. They finally raised rates in July, just a few weeks ago, finally, after they've had record inflation for months, and it's now at 0%. So talk about a union that has no room, none. So as soon as they started talking about raising the rates, you and I talked about how the Italian bond market started to break. And so Lagarde came out and said, oh, wait, don't worry. We're going to be there. We've got this anti-fragmentation tool. It's yield curve control, but it's deliberate yield curve control that picks out specific country bonds at specific maturity and specific denomination. So you've got, like, they may pick out the 2 year. They're saying the 10 year, we're going to defend the 10 year. Don't worry about it. And the 10 year came down. I don't know. I mean, if I'm an institutional investor, I don't particularly want to own those bonds, because the market, the free market, is telling you that they should be trading at a certain price. But now the ECB is coming in and essentially using the stronger countries' balance sheets to monetize their debt, to monetize Italy's debt and Greece's debt, right? So now you've got Germany, who's taking on the debt of these nations that are not operating at an efficient level. They're, you know, they should be, by all means, they should be defaulting on their debt at, you know, in at some rate here. And so how long can that last? I mean, you've studied it. You tell me, how long do you think it could last?
Well, I would have told you it couldn't have lasted this long, you know? So I'm obviously, I guess when I'm looking at the whole situation, like, where the hell was academia for the last decade in this situation where you were running negative rates? And instead of them speaking up and, you know, sounding the alarms and being the canaries in the coal mine, they were literally out writing books about MMT and how this MMT, is normal
the MMT
and
experiment.
How and yeah. how it needs to be more negative. And so it's just like, what's their incentive structure? Right. And then you pull back and they're being funded to write this crap, right? Well, by the same people that are causing it all.
Right. So, I mean, you could make the argument that we couldn't have made the productivity gains that we have without running deficits and debt. I mean, you could make
that argument. No, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
You know, but now we're addicted. I mean, there's no way off that there's no way off of that. That addiction, like you, everybody needs debt. Everybody's borrowing, you know,
everything has turned into a zombie from the individuals to the companies, to the governments. Exactly.
And here's the problem, right? So you had individuals and companies that were zombies that back in the great financial crisis.
Yeah.
Well, we kicked the individual problems up to the banks and straight up to the government. Well, where are we going to kick it now? Yeah. So there's nowhere to kick the problem any further. That's it. We're kind of at the end of the line. So the question isn't whether sovereigns start to fail. The question is which ones start failing first.
First.
And you know, emerging markets, their balance sheets are not as strong, and their currencies are not as strong. They don't, you know, we're seeing the US dollar soar here. Because people are they're taking risk off and they're looking for safety, right? So you're going to have smaller nations that fail. The currencies are going to fail. They're going to go into hyperinflation, and you know they're going to have to reset. And the question is, which G20 goes first? Is it Italy?
Do you think we see that in the coming 12 months? That we see a G20 go in the coming 12 months?
Well, I mean, I could get to a place where the EU has no choice but to talk about breaking up
within 12 months.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, this energy crisis, if it worsens, it's possible.
Yeah.
I don't predict that. I can get there, you know, but no, I don't think that do we see emerging markets fail in the next 12 months? It's very possible. A G20, I don't know.
But
these
James,
things
the thing,
take so long.
These,
right?
But once they start unraveling, they happen, I think, faster than everybody thinks it could happen.
I agree.
Right? Just and like any type of liquidation event. Like everyone, the thing agree. People all say is, it happened so fast. It happened like in the blink of an eye. And I think this situation that's brewing, I don't think people have an appreciation for how insanely fast this could ripple throughout every country, because I mean, everything's intertwined.
Right. And the US dollar will soar.
Yeah.
The US dollar will swallow everything, the milkshake theory, right? Mm-hmm. And I can see countries collapsing within, you know, absolutely in the next 3 to 5 years. I can see that happening. Well, how does that happen? Well, because we go through the one more cycle like this, right? And it seems like the cycles are getting shorter,
tighter,
right?
And more pronounced. Yeah.
Shorter, tighter, more pronounced. Right. And so I could see that happening where we go through this QE, we have our recession, hopefully not a depression, but we have a recession, and then we have our pivot. We go through QE again, you know, stop the QT, put bonds on balance sheets, whether it's the Fed or we change the reserve requirements, and then we start giving out entitlements, like we subsidize and we send out more checks, and that really causes inflation. And then the inflation runs so hot again that you've got to tighten again, but you raise those interest rates, you put more debt on the balance sheet. We're in the debt spiral, right? We're already in it. You put more debt on the bank's balance sheets, you borrow more as a US government, your tax receipts are going down again as you raise rates, yet your interest expense is going up. And it just goes in a stair step. And I could see it in the next maybe two cycles where it breaks a number of G20.
I don't know how you could possibly get, when I look at the streets of Philadelphia, San Francisco, New York, you name it, right? Name your city, right? Mm-hmm. How in the world could we possibly go another two cycles at this point without there just being absolute riot?
There you go. And that's the problem. The problem is that the separation of wealth is just being more and more pronounced. It's getting more pronounced with every single cycle, you know? And that's the issue. So when you've got Fed governors out there saying, well, I don't see a recession. I don't feel anything. Well, when you make, you know, $8,000 a week, whatever it is, you know, between their speaking engagements or whatever. I mean, of course you're not going to feel it. Come on, give me a break. You're going to Jackson Hole to talk about all the problems. You know,
I mean, Gulfstream was delayed. We're not leaving until 10.
We couldn't get gas, so we couldn't get jet fuel. So
I'm just,
yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's
insane.
Let's pivot to Bitcoin. So Eddie, I don't know if you know Eddie, but he posts some awesome questions online. He had a question for you. What is the most important change institutional investors are waiting for before changing mandates to include the direct BTC exposure?
I think they want clarity around regulations. You know, they want regulatory clarity. How is it going to be treated?
You saw Gary's write up this week, right?
I haven't seen it yet. No,
you didn't see his write up in the Wall Street Journal. No, he's basically like, hey, you know, all these borrowing and lending platforms were doing illegal things. And and this article was proof that they were, because we just said that they were. So have at it. That's basically
Did he lump in Bitcoin with it?
That was my 10 second summarization. Just any TLDR. Basically said that, it doesn't matter whether it's Bitcoin or any other token, like, because these borrowing and lending platforms are out there doing these things, these security like things, that there should have been disclosures by them to the public, and so the public has damages.
Regulation. Yeah. They want oversight. Yeah. And so I think there's a line there, though, how much oversight versus the strength of Bitcoin, you know, being hard money. When institutional investors get both clarity around regulation and their knowledge base rises, and they understand Bitcoin as a completely separate asset than an Ethereum, than a Cardano or Solana or whatever, when they can see how it's unique, and this has to do with educating the, you know, all of the investment managers that are going to be making these decisions. I can tell you right now, Preston, there's a lot of ignorant managers out there who have no idea the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum. None.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're dumb. They're not. I know very smart people who have no idea what the difference is and why they should be buying Bitcoin and treating it as a separate asset class. And part of the reason is, well, they don't need to know. They've done very well in this current system that they've been thriving in for decades. Yeah. They don't need to know what you know, what hard money is, they have manipulated money, and that's treated them very well. The fiat system has treated them very well. So that's number one. And then just the institutional money managers themselves have a lot of hurdles to get through. And we've talked about this before, and it doesn't get on their balance sheets quickly. It takes a long time. So you've got to get enough of them to get comfort around regulation and whether or not it's going to be, number one. And if it's not going to be, the comfort around that, understanding it, and then get through all of their processes and operational and legal settlement, custody processes that they have to iron out at each of those institutions in order to own it as a separate asset class. And that's going to take time. But
do you think pain is the instructor for them to try to understand it? And when I say pain, I mean all these supply chains are breaking down, our prices are blowing out. Like, how does this possibly solve itself? When I look at the Fed, they're going to keep printing more. They're doing QE. Does all of that force them to try to understand what this is?
It could, but you've got all of this noise out there around proof of work versus, you know, proof of stake, right? So, and the amount of energy that Bitcoin uses to, you know, be mined. And there's going to be a lot of noise about that over the next year or two. And that's just, unfortunately, that's been a headwind, and it's going to increase. And I have no idea what's going to happen with Ethereum in a few weeks. I have no clue if it's going to work or not going to work or what's going to happen.
Sounds like you know the same as the developers.
Right? Did you hear that conversation?
Insane.
Crazy.
Insane.
Yeah, I think you said that to me. It's insane.
Let me ask you this then, James, on the energy side. So, you know, I was talking with Parker and Will Cole last week, and they were down in Houston, and I asked them, is it inevitable that you're going to see this merging of infrastructure between the miners and large cap energy companies? And they both looked at me and they're like, yeah, like that's happening.
No brainer.
It's a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer.
So do the Apples of the world who are not in that particular space that might be looking at this and saying, well, I don't know which one of these things are going to win. I just know that we've got issues and they're not getting resolved. When they look over at an ExxonMobil or a Shell, who I think is Shell sponsoring the Bitcoin 2023 event?
Is it really?
I think it's either ExxonMobil or Shell, or like one of these large cap energy companies is sponsoring the next Bitcoin conference down in Miami. And
that's a big deal.
It's a huge deal.
It's a big deal.
So I think you're going to all these narratives around energy and how corrosive proof of work is to energy. I think these energy companies are like, cool story, bro, but we just, you know, doubled our bottom line or whatever. And we're actually having a favorable environmental impact by actually storing all this energy that we'd be just, you know, pissing over the dam or, you know, not capturing. Right.
Exactly. Just like, you're just flaring gas. I mean, it's just,
it's crazy.
It's a massive amount of waste, right? So, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because I was thinking about that in the Bitcoin conference this year and how much fun. I mean, and that was my first conference. I had never been to the Bitcoin conference before in Miami. I thought how much fun it was to be around all these people who are super passionate about this emerging technology, but it's really, you know, it's really a global money saving discovery, right?
Yeah.
So, and the energy around there is just incredible. I was looking around, I was thinking, well, what's it going to be like when you've got Goldman Sachs here and Credit Suisse, or maybe not Credit Suisse anymore, but, you know, JP Morgan, and like you said, Exxon and Shell and all these major companies and Apple, and everybody's there. And, you know, Apple's in there talking about Lightning, and, you know, Exxon's talking about mining.
It's going to be time for us to find a different venue.
Goldman, right? And it's going to be boring, right? It's going to be boring. But I can tell you this, that's where it's going. Because once it gets institutionally adopted, they're going to be all over that space. And that's when you know it's just the momentum is just too great. And I think that we're already at. So to answer your question succinctly, I truly believe, Preston, that momentum is just too great to stop. The problems are just too great to solve. And that merging is what absolutely makes Bitcoin win. Yeah. And it's not even that we're going to have a fight and we've got to make sure that we clarify it. But I think that is just about the length of time it takes to get there versus the whether or not it does.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, so, does it happen quickly because people come to their senses and realize, oh, the solution is literally smacking me in the face? Or do they battle it and fight it and, you know, end up losing anyway in the long run? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's coming. I just think that the momentum's already there. We've seen Fidelity, BlackRock, you know, JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon's talking about it. You know, they have experts on their desks that are working on this and creating the ability for their high net worth portfolios to own it. I mean, the momentum is there. It's not going away. So.
Yeah. Yeah, they're working on the merch.
They're working on the merch. Got it.
Hey, God help us. There's a couple of cheap shots here. So I think we already covered this earlier when we were talking about the debt spiral, but I just want to highlight this question because this is something that I think a lot of people have this question online. Mm-hmm. And Lynn has done an outstanding job explaining why we haven't seen inflation actually materialize after 2008, when we were doing QE. And in her article and a couple different articles that she's highlighted, she's saying, hey, it really needs to be the Fed and the Treasury acting together, monetizing the debt and doing QE simultaneously for it to actually start spilling over into what, you know, everybody would see when they're checking out at the grocery store to see inflation actually making its way to the consumer. And so this is the question that the person posed. They said, what changed in 2020 that wasn't happening from 2008 to 2020 that got the Treasury also working with the Fed to cause this debasement and these inflationary prints to start manifesting themselves?
I think the simplest thing is we just sent checks directly to consumers, right? Mm-hmm. That's the, I mean, we sent trillions of dollars into people's bank accounts. So it immediately caused a demand for goods, number one. Number two, our supply chains were broken. We were in lockdowns everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, things weren't being made. They weren't being shipped. Mm-hmm. You couldn't find certain things. You know, I mean, the used car market, like you would have done better if you had a used car than, you know, if then I think if you had bought silver at that point, you know, I mean, like,
yeah.
So there just were there. I think that just that combination has that has been a major driver where you just saw it immediately. And then it just got exacerbated with the energy crisis. You know, the fact that we don't have enough refineries to keep up with demand here in America. I mean, we can be energy independent without, you know, a blink, obviously. But right now we don't, the refineries get to capacity pretty quickly. So we're draining our emergency reserves, right? Our special reserves. So there are a lot of different. So and I just think that exacerbated the issue.
So let me ask this because it kind of piggybacks on that. And so is your opinion that a lot of this disruption and a lot of this inflation is hanging around because of those factors, but moving from time now forward, because we're now in the, in this debt spiral and they have to monetize the debt because you're in this spiral type situation that the interest expense is now exceeding what we can actually handle.
Absolutely. It's pure math, right? It's pure math. And so inflation, what people have to understand is, and I was talking to my wife about it, and she's like, well, when do you think the prices will come down for some of these goods that we've seen just rise so exponentially? I'm like, they're not.
That's when you gave her the Anakin Skywalker, you know, smirk to Natalie Portman, right?
Right. Like she's super smart.
They're not,
you know, but people, it's really hard to get your head around the prices of things now, like just anything. Name anything.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get your head around the prices. And so people are like, well, when are we going to see these prices come down? It's like, we're not, you know, you're just going to see them go up a little bit slower, you know? So yeah, I think it's sticky and it's because of all the underlying issues that you laid out. No question.
Yeah. Cause we didn't have this debt spiral scenario prior to 2020. Like it was getting bad. Right. You could see it moving in that direction. But now
but that's when it got out of control. Yeah. That was kind of the tip off.
That yeah. But now it's just pure 11th grade math, as Greg would say.
That's right.
What's caused the Japanese credit markets to kind of calm down a little bit from the last time we talked? Because I remember we threw up a chart and we were looking at the volatility across the whole duration of their curve, and it was looking like somebody was trying to blow through the yield curve control. And it looks like whoever that was or whatever was causing that has kind of calmed. Has backed off.
Yeah. Those are huge hedge fund trades, right? Where they were selling JGBs. And, you know, so what they're trying to do is take the opposite position, right? So they were like short swap positions by hedge funds as they go the short JGBs and long yen, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a counterforce to, you know, what Japan is trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. The Bank of Japan. Well, then when it looked like the Fed was already becoming dovish and they're going to pivot, this is one of the, I believe that Japan is, they're playing a game of chicken with the Fed, right? They're hoping that the Fed blinks before they do and they pause. Right. So it's simple search for yield is a major driver of currencies. Right. So when you own a 10-year treasury in Japan, and to catch your listeners up for those who hadn't heard this before, the Bank of Japan has instituted what they call yield curve control, where they are buying every single 10-year treasury to keep the interest rate at 25 basis points, 0.25%. So they'll buy endless treasuries to do that. Well, they've proven that, as now the Bank of Japan owns more than 50% of all outstanding Japanese government debt, which is just insane. But this is what they're doing. And that reverse trade of the hedge funds were betting that they wouldn't be able to hold on, right? My guess, I haven't done scientific work on this, but it just points to this, is that those same traders saw Powell come out a few weeks ago and sound kind of dovish that meeting, and they thought the Fed's going to blink first. And so they unwound a lot of those trades and the pressure came off. Mm-hmm. But you saw in the last few days, you saw the yen spike lower again to just under 140. And so, you know, we talked about the fact that for your listeners, if investors want to sell Japanese bonds and there's yield curve control there, so they sell the bonds to the government, and the government's standing there in the open market buying them, right? So then they get yen for those bonds. Well, they're in search of yield. And the best yield in the world right now for the major countries and the major currencies is the US dollar, is the US Treasury. We're at 3%. So they can, instead of getting 0.25% for the Japanese yield, they can take those yen, sell them, and buy US dollars to get the 10-year treasury at 3% instead of getting 0.25%. Now, if they want to hedge out the currency, they're going to have to make a currency bet, or they'll hedge out the currency. And that's actually been a driver, negative driver for US treasuries recently. Yeah, but the long and short of it is, that's kind of the pressure. And that's
so, James, right? After you hedge out that currency risk, you have to make up the 3.5%, which I think is what makes that so hard to do and why you're not necessarily seeing it happen. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So there's got to be a release valve somewhere. So that's what's happening. Yeah. And it's gone. It's back to where it was a few weeks ago, where, you know, there's pressure on the yen and there's pressure on those treasuries.
Yeah.
So, and if the Bank of Japan stands there and buys the treasuries, well, the release valve is the yen, period. That's it. Simple as that.
This was an interesting question, and this relates to what we're talking about there. Dr. Anton, help explain why advanced economies can't get away, and he used it in quotations, get away with doing what Japan does, at least for a few more years, with low inflation, yield curve control, and big debt to GDP ratio. How are they able to do what they're doing over there, but no one else can get away with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I think it has to do with the fact that Japan, you know, they run, they're actually a net exporter. Yep. Yeah. And the US is a net importer, you know, most economies are, right?
Yeah.
And so most of the major ones. So the question is, like, we can't get away with it because we don't have that same
surplus
trade balance surplus.
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to do, you know, and so it just won't work. And they've had low interest rates for so long. And, you know, their current account surplus is what I'm trying to say. I'm kind of fumbling around with my words here because we took so long to get up and running here, Preston. Sorry.
A little bit tired. I look at it almost like a company with like retained earnings. Is the company making money or is it not making money? From like a country kind of level, right?
Yeah. I mean, so they've got, yeah. And you know, the international investments in there, it's a net positive, mm-hmm. And they've got low wealth concentration. You know, actually, these are points that Lynn made, you know, she actually, I read something from a long time ago. It feels like a long time ago. Might have been last week, but you know, she basically said U.S. is in the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. Lynn Alden, for your listeners, sorry, the U.S. is in the exact opposite position. You know, they've got a current account deficit. They have
it's getting, you know, wider.
Their international investment position is negative, and it's far more negative. And we have a super high, you know, concentration of wealth in this country. And then the other thing is that Japan was doing it during a period that we were having, you know, global deflation up until now. So I don't know what's going to happen with them now. I think they're in it. They have a problem, but that's why the U.S. can't get away with it. It just doesn't work. It's just not going to work.
So last question I got for you, James, you have a awesome thread where you lay out 25 years in finance, what you learned, your top five things they were, and I'm going to read these off quickly. Don't be the smartest guy in the room. Fortunes are made in fear. Don't get killed. Eat what you kill, and banks work for us. Talk to us about your favorite one of those five and maybe give us a story or something to kind of leave folks with.
That's a good question. You know, let's see, that thread, that's funny. I wrote that, you know, I think it was one of that's the first thread I ever wrote.
Oh, no way. I love it. It's an awesome thread.
Thank you. I think the one that I come back to, I keep coming back to, especially with Bitcoin, is you eat what you kill. But really the underlying thing with that one is your conviction in a long-term investment. Mm. As an investor, you know, all the other things that are in there, kind of like risk measures and, you know, or using the leverage for your balance sheet intelligently, but having a conviction. Some people, they get tied up with the emotion of something, and people are really emotional about Bitcoin. I've seen this in some pretty amazing and pretty negative ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they get so confident that they'll take out leverage on it and use Bitcoin as a collateral. It's a volatile asset, taking out leverage on a volatile asset to, you know, margin their trade, and then they just get wiped out. You see that. Okay. So having conviction really, for me, has to do with a long-term investment. Like, you know, you look at it and you've got probability analysis on it, and you're looking for the low risk, high reward, and versus a super high conviction in your analysis of an investment that you want to take a long-term position in. And that's where you'll hear Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger, as much as they don't understand Bitcoin, you'll hear them talk about taking these opportunities where there's a mispriced opportunity in the market because they have such high conviction in it. They have no problem with buying it all the way down and just sitting on it for years.
They know what they own.
And that's the one that honestly I keep coming back to.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
Yeah. I love that.
Excuse me, I had to cough. And that's what's driven me in Bitcoin. And so I don't care that it's down at $20,000. Yeah. I know that there are extraneous forces on it, you know, that there's a lot of noise around this as an emerging asset class and an emerging money, hard money. And so for me, having the conviction and understanding it and understanding why it's different from the fiat currency we have now, how it's decentralized, how it's scarce, how it's trustless, you know, these are things that not having counterparty risk in something that I own is incredible. I mean,
insane.
You would say it's no different than having gold in a vault in your house, except if I'm in the Ukraine or if I'm in Venezuela and I need to flee my country because it's dissolving.
It's imaginary vault.
Dissolving. You saw the woman who was stopped at the border trying to get across the border with suitcases full of money. Well, she just had 12 words in her head. She could have gotten across the border with all her money.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's just something that, and I just have such high conviction in it, that that's the one I just keep it coming back to.
Yeah. Love it. James, thank you so much for having this discussion. I just want to tell folks, so your newsletter, phenomenal. It's so easy to sign up for. Just I'll have a link in the show notes to the newsletter and also your Twitter feed. But for people, just go to James's Twitter feed and there's a button right there under his name and you just click subscribe and you'll start getting his newsletter. And I mean, he is putting out phenomenal, like high value add, just like, you know, what you heard today, his comments are just so valuable. So I would highly encourage people to check that out. I know I'm a subscriber to it and just really look forward to anything that you put out.
It's free. It's free.
And it's completely free. He's not selling.
I mean, I tried to do is what I do is every single week, I sit down on a Saturday morning, I put on Premier League soccer and I start, and I just write. I write about one financial concept that I can simplify for people. And I got tired of, you know, Preston, I got tired of people saying, you know, your business is so opaque. Mm. Wall Street is so opaque. They're trying to hide things from us. And I think that they're just not incentivized to tell people what's going on. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to tell you what's going on. I'm going to give it to you in layman's terms so you can understand it. It's not that difficult. These concepts are not that difficult. Mm-hmm. The terms may sound crazy. Yield curve control, credit default swap, you know, I mean, the repo and reverse repo. I mean, it's not that difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate it. I appreciate you sharing that.
It's a no-brainer,
it's
man.
It's something that I have a passion for. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. We'll have a link to your Twitter. Is there anything else that you wanted to highlight for folks?
No, this is awesome. I appreciate it. I always appreciate having an evening chat with Preston about macro.
We need to have some bourbon next time we do this. Yeah, James.
Definitely.
Yeah.
That's a deal. All right.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. Always a blast. And thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you, Preston.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show or you learned something new or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that. And it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.